Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution with Philip Coppins and
Kathleen McGowan.
Today's subject is a subject which is very close to both of our hearts and even closer to Kathleen, who has devoted pretty much of two books to the mystery of labyrinths. The two books I'm talking about is The Book of Love and her most recent self-help non-fiction book, The Source of Miracles. Kathleen, labyrinths are very close to your heart. Why?
I first discovered the labyrinth as a source of spiritual use, as a tool for meditation and prayer, back in the middle of the 90s. And at the time, I was, you know, a complete neophyte. I had no idea what a labyrinth was. I mean, certainly I'd seen pictures of them, but I think, like most people, I was of the opinion that a labyrinth and a maze were essentially the same thing. I mean, certainly in England, in the British Gardens, you see a lot of these hedge mazes. We have the concept of corn mazes and all of these other things in America, which are very much places where people get lost. And of course, as I like to say, what I learned that the primary difference between a labyrinth and a maze is that a maze is where people get lost, and a labyrinth is where people are found and find themselves. The difference between a labyrinth and a maze is that a labyrinth is designed so that there is only one path into the center and one path back out. You can't get lost in a labyrinth. You just have to stay true to your path, and you will always find yourself in the center where you belong. So it's a great metaphor for all of us for staying on our spiritual path and being true to ourselves and having real integrity in the way that we live our lives. And so what I learned amongst this, the many, many things there are to know about labyrinths, is that often the labyrinth itself, in terms of what it is and how it's constructed, has much to teach us.
I think it's also the fact that mazes are more for entertainment purposes, whereas labyrinths actually go back thousands and thousands of years. In a recent article I did, and which is available on my website, there's actually evidence of labyrinths going back 7,000 years to places like Siberia. And the labyrinth symbol really is a universal symbol. The Hopis in Arizona use it and see it as a place of emergence, whereby at each new birth of a new era, the labyrinth is an identifier of a place of emergence. So it's a very important subject. But I think really labyrinths are mostly famous for being connected to churches.
Well, I think that the modern mind is most familiar with the churches that appear in the Gothic cathedrals in France. There are labyrinths actually outside of France. They tend to be very small. The larger walkable labyrinths that tend to be in naves in the Gothic structures in France are essentially unique to that country and that culture. There were some mazes... There were some labyrinths in Italy that were walkable in the late Middle Ages, but they are no longer available. Most of them have either been covered up or destroyed. The same is true in France. Some of these extraordinary labyrinths that were originally installed into the Gothic cathedrals in France were also destroyed by the church. The church dug them up or had them eliminated, for the most part, in the 18th and 19th centuries. Their reasons for doing so are something that we question, and we're going to get a little bit later in the show, we're going to get into this idea of what these church labyrinths were about and what the reason that these church labyrinths are considered controversial even today, and specifically the great controversies that exist around the Chartres Labyrinth, which is a huge point of contention for me, something I care about passionately, and something I really do want to talk about, because I feel that the Chartres Labyrinth is one of the most important spiritual tools and symbols in the Western world, and I feel like it is being systematically destroyed, and I think that we need to put a stop to that. So I want to talk about that a little bit later in the show, but I want to back up and say, you know, this concept of labyrinths and how important they are and what they actually mean is something that no one has ever agreed upon. Okay, everything about labyrinths is controversial. who built them, why they built them, what they're for, what their origins are. I have had fantastically spirited conversations with labyrinth experts the world over, and nobody agrees. And, you know, and I think that's one of the things that makes them truly, truly interesting. For anyone out there listening who wants a great place to start, there are many, many labyrinth books on the market. But the encyclopedia of all things labyrinth, and it's quite a large book and it's a little bit costly, but check it out from your library if it's not something you want to invest in, and that is Hermann Kern. He did the definitive study on the labyrinth, the history of the labyrinth, and encyclopedia of the labyrinth. So if you can grab Hermann Kern's book on the labyrinth, you are going to get so much information on where labyrinths started and what their origins are and where they're located. You know, when we look at things like labyrinths that have been around for 7,000 years old, there are certainly these very, certainly pagan-looking labyrinths. The Cretan labyrinth look very different from what we now think of as the Christian labyrinths, the labyrinths in the cathedrals, because these are very geometrically perfect. They're created with a very a precise type of geometry and numerology, most of these labyrinths. Now, what became totally fascinating to me when I started studying them, and I found it originally through Kern's work, which took me to a number of amazing places, specifically Italy, but Kern talks about Solomon's labyrinths, that there are a number of places in documentation from antiquity that refer to the labyrinth built by Solomon. And this was really fascinating for me because, of course, we have King Solomon as the great creator of the temple. So why wouldn't he then also be the great creator of something that was as precise and extraordinary and a type of perhaps traveling temple as the labyrinth? And that is a concept that I got very interested in exploring, this idea that labyrinths in churches and outside of churches, as they were designed by Solomon originally, and that would be these 11 circuit labyrinths, the labyrinths that we see on the wall in churches like Lucca, certainly the Chartres labyrinth. These are 11 circuit labyrinths. And our first documented information about these labyrinths being attributed to Solomon comes from a Greek text from the 11th century. So in Greece in the 11th century, we have this extraordinary text, which is essentially an alchemical treatise, and it gives all kinds of alchemical formulas, and within it, there is a beautiful, very perfect drawing of an 11th circuit labyrinth, which is referred to as a Solomon labyrinth. And this concept then shows up in later dates, whether or not that is a copy from this document or another is hard to know, but we certainly know that this original concept of 11 circuits in and 11 circuits out using master numbers, right? 11 is a master number, 22 is a master number, using certain types of geometry and numerology is attributed to Solomon by the Greeks at least as early as 11th century and probably much earlier than that.
There's an interesting mixture here of Christian knowledge and pagan knowledge. At one point, it's clear that the labyrinth as a concept is much older than Christianity. Then it gets somehow incorporated into Christianity. But in your books, which are about this heretical tradition, which is part of Christianity, and to some extent at the basis of Christianity, there is more to it than that. And when you point out things like Lucca and Chartres, and then when you see how the church treats with almost utter disdain these labyrinths in their churches, it's almost as if there's a pagan tradition hidden inside of them. And yet when you hear the official position about what labyrinths are supposed to be, it is said that it is built for those people who could not go to Jerusalem. It's for those pilgrims who somehow couldn't sell everything or abandon their homes and their families and go to Jerusalem, either on a pilgrimage or as part of some quest. And those people who had to stay behind were going to walk the labyrinth, and then somehow when they reached the center of the labyrinth, to them that was almost like Jerusalem. It was this quest in miniature. What's your opinion about the official explanation and how the church kind of like has it right or wrong?
Well, I mean, I think that this concept of the labyrinths being a substitution for the pilgrimage to Jerusalem for the average person is in itself kind of a lovely idea, but it's certainly an easy idea. I think it's an easy out for the church. I think often the Catholic Church has been forced to come up with very acceptable explanations for things that are not necessarily easily explainable within the Gothic cathedrals. You know, I make the case in the Book of Love that these Gothic cathedrals are books in stone, and they are books that preserve the original teachings of Christianity before they were altered by dogma and politics. And I think that some of the elements in these cathedrals are decidedly heretical, and in that regard, potentially scary for the church. But what I want to say about the labyrinth as a tool is I want to get away from the concept of it being pagan or Christian, because I think it's none of those things and all of those things. I think what the labyrinth as a tool is Gnostic. And I don't necessarily mean Gnostic in terms of Gnostic Christianity, but I mean Gnostic in terms of knowledge, of wisdom. The labyrinth is a personal tool where the human being has the opportunity to work their mind, body, and spirit together in a holistic prayer practice, a holistic meditational practice, because that's literally holistic, isn't it? We're using the mind, the body, and the spirit. The labyrinth is a walking prayer. It's a walking meditation. And in this regard, it's also it's a fantastic tool for people who are not good at being still. The average human being isn't good at this concept of being still and meditating. You know, you hear Westerners sometimes say, oh, well, you know, it's contemplating your navel and that kind of thing. Well, the labyrinth gets you out of that, doesn't it? It gets you moving. It is moving your body at the same time that you are also working your mind and engaging your spirit. And in that regard, it's a holistic tool that's available to everybody. And the idea is, as you are walking into these circuits toward the center, you are getting closer to God. And however you want to refer to God, it can be God, it can be the goddess, it can be divine mind, it can be spirit, it can be your higher self, whatever it is that you need to communicate with spiritually awaits you there in the center. And so in that regard, I believe that the labyrinths are entirely universal and completely non-denominational. Now, I think if you are a church with a structure that is based on a hierarchy of authority, presenting a tool to your congregation that allows them to talk directly to God so they no longer need the interaction of priests or bishops is problematic. And I think that this becomes part of the problem for the church. I think the idea that the labyrinth is something that people can use on their own to connect directly to God and be Gnostic, get their own wisdom and have their own connection to the divine, is certainly something that is threatening to a traditional church. Beyond that, I think there is a connection to the female element, the divine feminine, and we're going to get into that in a minute, because I also think that is the second piece of what makes the labyrinth a little bit risky, if not utterly dangerous, for a traditional Catholic environment.
It's definitely a case, I think, that when you look at the Gothic cathedrals, people have always looked upon this element of heresy, of this shift of the norm, and the fact that all Gothic cathedrals were this beautiful expression of common ownership, of people working together, and Chartres probably is the best example of this. There is not a single inscription anywhere which identifies that Mr. X or Mrs. X contributed to this. It's a work of communion. And this sense of communion is very much alive when the labyrinth is open, when people just come there from all kinds of places. And to some extent, Chartres Labyrinth has become a place of pilgrimage itself. It if you follow the official church stance, it should have been Jerusalem. But now, for everybody else, Chartres has become this place of pilgrimage because it is one of the very few surviving Gothic places. And even though, and we'll come back to this later as well, Chartres Labyrinth has many copies around the world, I think none of those copies actually do true justice to completely experiencing the surroundings of Chartres in which the labyrinth has been placed, because it's not just the labyrinth itself, it's also the place, Chartres Cathedral, of which it is part and parcel.
Well, the hill upon which Chartres Cathedral is built is sacred ground, and it has been considered sacred territory in Europe for at least 5,000 years and perhaps longer. I make the case in the Book of Love that the ancients there believed that it was the pulse point of the universe and that the actual blood of the Divine Mother ran through Chartres, and that well that is now encased in the crypt in Chartres Cathedral represents a direct access to the Divine Mother, the Mother Goddess, the Mother who is our Earth. And there is all kinds of information from our history, archaeologically, folklorically, and in some cases recorded, that bears that out. And I go through this in great detail in the Book of Love. And then in my last book, the nonfiction book, The Source of Miracles, I talk a little bit more about these legends about how Chartres was built. Because to your point, there is something so extraordinarily powerful and magical about that structure. I get so many letters from people who are going there now as a result of my books, and they all come back and say they walk in there and they are just absolutely awestruck. And it's not just the architecture, it's not just the stained glass. When you walk into Chartres, you have an absolute sense that you are entering a temple. You are entering a place where wisdom and knowledge and spirit has been protected and housed for not only hundreds of years since the structures have been there, but for thousands of years since people have been coming here as a place of worship. So in that regard, there is something so special about Chartres because of its location. And then on top of that, you have the layers upon layers of beauty, of power, of spirit, of wisdom that have assembled there in all kinds of guises, pagan, Christian, heretical, but in all cases devotional. And that, for me, is what you feel when you walk into Chartres. Whether you are a devout Catholic or a heretic or a pagan or an art lover, you cannot walk in there and not feel devotion in that space. And that's the thing about it that I think is utterly magical and completely unique. And it's the element about it that I also feel needs to be protected. And what is hard for me lately, and again, we'll talk about this in more specific detail a little bit later in the show, what is hard for me personally is to see the current structure of the Catholic Church trying to eradicate that and eliminate that and saying that the rest of those traditions do not matter and are not allowed to matter, and only the specific point of view taken by the Catholic Church at this moment is the only thing that we are allowed to accept when we walk into the doors of that structure. And I'm afraid I just will never accept that, and I think it's something that really needs to be talked about. Chartres Cathedral is a UNESCO heritage site. It belongs to the world for its importance, and I think that that needs to be celebrated and expressed, and I'm certainly hoping and going to encourage people to look at it in a new way, because I do believe that it is, in a lot of ways, the temple of man.
You're about to read from the Book of Love, the story of Ariadne, and when you look at the history of labyrinths, and even Chartres, they said that at the center of Chartres Labyrinth there was a depiction of Theseus killing the Minotaur, which you will talk about when you're reading from the Book of Love. But there's a lot of controversy as to where labyrinths in Western civilization began. And it is said that Theseus found his idea in Egypt. Now, on my website and on the website of the Spirit Revolution, which is thespiritrevolution.com, we will post the links to two articles which actually goes into this question as to how Egypt became part of this tradition. The labyrinth in Egypt is said to be in Hawara, is said to be linked to a pyramid, and there's a lot of controversy at the moment as to whether or not it still exists, and Egyptian sources are trying to dig it up. But in short, I think the consensus is that if there ever was a labyrinth in ancient Egypt, it's very much like a maze, in the sense that this was a very complex building with thousands of chambers, potentially a serapeum, which is a kind of necropolis but for sacred bulls. And obviously the Minotaur is linked with the bull cult. So it is said that the people from Crete got their idea from Egypt. But again, as outlined before, even if Crete got its idea from Egypt, it's clear that the symbol was universal. The Hopis knew about it on the American continent, and 5,000 years ago, 3,000 BC, roughly a millennium and a half before the Cretan civilization existed, people in Siberia were using the device as well.
Well, certainly there's also a lot of allegory in these stories about the labyrinth, these legends of the labyrinth, Theseus going into the center and slaying the Minotaur and saving the people. And I'm going to read that story actually for you right now. And the version I'm going to read, I think, is critically important because it really is the focus of this story is the Lady Ariadne. There is a legend that at the center of Shark Cathedral, there was a plaque that showed Theseus slaying the Minotaur. No one knows anymore actually what was in that plaque. I would actually make the case that Ariadne may have been depicted in that plaque. And one of the things that I want to talk about, I'm going to read this piece of the story, and then we'll talk about this, because this really leads into the concept of the divine feminine aspect of the labyrinth. And that is my argument, is certainly in the Greek tradition, that this story, the story of the labyrinth and the Minotaur and Ariadne, is originally Ariadne's story. She is the focus. She is the legend. Her as the lady of the labyrinth and the ability of love to change the world and aid the hero is, for me, the crux of this story. And then what we find later on is that Ariadne is actually written out of the story, for the most part by the monks who then begin to translate this story later on in medieval times. They actually remove her. Ariadne is completely eliminated from her own legend, and that's when it becomes a legend about the Minotaur and Theseus. But before that, there was a very, very beautiful love story, and this is the version I'm going to read to you. It is the version that I publish in my second novel, The Book of Love. This comes from a heretical tradition, from a book called the Libro Rosso, the Red Book, which was kept in Italy for hundreds of years and passed down through these heretical Christians who had evolved separately from the church Christian tradition. The Minotaur was a great monster born into the family of the king of Crete, the powerful ruler known as Minos, and his wife, Queen Pasiphae. He was half man, half bull, and had the appetite of 10 wild beasts. It is said that the Minotaur was the result of Pasiphae's illicit encounter with a god, or worse, with a great white bull. This has likely been misunderstood by judgmental men who could not grasp the great mysteries of the ancients. It is likely that Queen Pasiphae was a priestess of the moon and the embodiment of the sacred feminine, and that her mating with a priest, in his guise as a bull to represent the sacred masculine, was the enactment of a ritual that has been considered a holy mystery since the dawn of mankind. A ritual of the union of masculine and feminine energies, necessary for the balance of life on the earth. Thus the history of how the Minotaur was conceived is shrouded in mystery, but we know this. He existed as a combination of the human and the divine, and he was half miraculous and half terrible as a result. Perhaps it is the mysterious existence of the Minotaur wherein lies the secret of the fall. Perhaps he is a symbol of the great loss of understanding that occurs when humans are no longer able to accept our divine natures, and most of all, the loss to our humanity when we abandon the necessity of honoring the masculine and feminine together in its most divine form. The given name of the Minotaur was Asterius, as he was a star being, as a result of his divine origins. He was revered as one of the gods at the same time that he was the object of terror and fear amongst the humans. His body was covered with a pattern of stars as a reminder that all creatures come from heaven, even those who appear to have only a base nature. It is from heaven that we come, and to heaven we will return, for that which is above is also below. Was Asterius born a monster, a terrible creature who would demand human sacrifice and terrorize the peace of Crete? Or was he a monster because he was denied love and subjected to ridicule, cruelty, and judgment? He was most certainly a source of shame for King Minos, who could not bear that his wife had conceived without him, even if it was with a divine being. Minos was driven to the brink of madness by jealousy and wanted nothing more than to destroy Asterius, but he dared not put the monster to death because of his divine paternity. Instead, the king devised an underground prison in which to house this unwanted creature and shield him from his sight. There lived in Minos a refugee from Athens named Daedalus the Inventor, who was summoned by Minos to create a prison in which to house the Minotaur. It was in devising this terrible structure that Daedalus became a master builder. What he conceived was a labyrinth, an enormous and circuitous type of maze that led to a midpoint. Here in the midpoint was the temple in which the creature would dwell. The construction of this labyrinth was such that once he was inside, it was impossible to find his way out. This served to contain the Minotaur, but also to entrap his unfortunate victims. For the construction of the labyrinth was such that once they were inside, they would not be able to escape. As his monstrous due, the Minotaur demanded a sacrifice of 7 girls and 7 boys to be sent into the center of the labyrinth every 9 years, all of whom he devoured without a trace. Thus Asterius the Minotaur lived the life of a god monster, out of the sight of the people of Crete, and trapped in his subterranean labyrinth, yet as a shadow cast over the land every 9 years. King Minos and Queen Pasiphae went on to have human children, among them the lovely and kind princess called Ariadne. The Minoan princess was renowned for her radiant beauty and was referred to throughout the lands as the Clear and Bright One, and was also known to be utterly pure of spirit and heart. It came to pass that Crete was at war with Athens. The brother of Ariadne and the only true son of Minos, a hero called Androgeus, was slain by the Athenians in a battle. King Minos howled in his grief at the loss of his son and declared absolute terror on Athens in revenge. As part of his conquest, Minos demanded that the Athenians supply the tribute to the Minotaur from their own children, and henceforth the 14 sacrificial innocents were taken from Athens. The youngest son of the Athenian king was a beautiful and heroic youth called Theseus, and so it was when it came time for the Athenians to send their terrible sacrifice to the Minotaur, Theseus volunteered to go in as the first of the 14, determined as he was to face the Minotaur and slay him, thus saving the lives of future innocents and liberating the people of Athens from this terror. For even in his youth, this hero was wise beyond all years. He understood that the offering of sacrifices to the Minotaur was a choice. It was a tradition that did not need to be kept, but it would take someone with great courage to stop it. The Princess Ariadne was walking on the beach near the harbor in Crete when the ship from Athens landed to unload the sacrificial victims. It is said that she caught sight of Theseus and fell immediately in love with him, recognizing him as the bright hero who could defeat the darkness that lurked below the surface of Crete in the guise of her half-brother, the terrible Minotaur Asterius. She had been haunted throughout her life by the slaying of innocents to satisfy his inhuman hunger, and yet the compassion in her heart also gave her great sympathy for his monstrous suffering. Ariadne arranged a secret tryst with Theseus on the eve prior to the sacrificial ceremony. Here, Ariadne vowed her aid in return for his own promise to marry her and take her away with him. As it was, the fair Ariadne had been promised by her father as a bride to the debauched god Dionysus. It was said that the god, driven half mad by his passion for the pure beauty of Ariadne, had demanded her as a tribute from Minos in exchange for military victories over the Athenians. Minos had relented with some reluctance, but the deal had been struck. But the pure Lady Ariadne was a devoted disciple of Aphrodite, the goddess of love. As such, she could not bear the thought of marrying for any reason other than true love, and certainly not in submitting to a fate as the debased concubine of the god of hedonism. Upon setting eyes on Theseus, Ariadne fell in love with him and knew that he could change her destiny. Theseus would rescue the people from the Minotaur and Ariadne from the dark god and both salvations would happen through the force of love. It is said that Ariadne and Theseus joined together that night in passion and purpose, flesh and spirit, trust and consciousness. In that way, she shielded him within the pure power of her love. Because Ariadne was the half-sister of the terrible beast, she knew the secrets to slaying the Minotaur and exiting the labyrinth. All these she shared with her new love. Ariadne then wove strands of her own silken hair into a skein of golden yarn to create a magical thread called a clue, in which to aid her love's escape from the labyrinth. Finally, she presented him with the miraculous sword, a weapon once forged for the sea god Poseidon himself. It was crafted of silver and gold to represent the light of the sun and the moon as they reflect off the sea. Ariadne knew that this weapon would kill her half-brother without causing him any suffering. Theseus would not fail to kill the Minotaur with a single true and merciful blow and emerge as a hero of the light if he followed her instructions perfectly. The following morning, as he was being led into the labyrinth as the first sacrifice, Theseus fastened one end of Ariadne's thread to an iron ring at the entrance post of the labyrinth, tying it in the symbolic bridal knot exactly as she had shown him. He carried the ball of magical thread inside with him, unraveling it slowly as he walked the circuitous path toward the hideous beast. At the center of the labyrinth, Theseus met the Minotaur and defeated him in honorable hand-to-hand combat, shielded by Ariadne's love, and delivering the final blow with the magical weapon that she had provided. His task complete, the hero retraced his steps out of the labyrinth by following Ariadne's thread, thus arriving safely at the entrance of the labyrinth and into the embrace of his newly beloved. Carrying off his princess, Theseus freed the remaining 13 Athenian children and returned to their ship as the liberator of his people and the great slayer of the god Beast. They sailed until arriving on the island of Dia, where they stopped for a night of celebration and to gather provisions for their return to Athens. Sadly, their joy was cut short when the wine-crazed god Dionysus appeared on Dia to claim his bride. Ariadne was his by the right of human and divine law, he said, betrothed by her royal father, and with no will of her own to resist. Theseus resisted the god at first, claiming that Ariadne was his by her own choice, and that it was his intention to make her the queen of Athens. Dionysus countered by reminding Theseus that he could make Ariadne immortal through her marriage to a god, and that if the Athenian truly loved her, he would release her to a more divine destiny. This argument lasted into the night, with the god Dionysus relentless in his attack on Theseus. It was a terrible choice for the young Athenian prince, who was no match for the clever and determined god. In the end, Theseus believed that if he resisted Dionysus, the god would likely take Ariadne by force and inflict harm upon him and the remainder of the Athenians. And so it was with a heavy heart Theseus abandoned his Ariadne to the will of Dionysus and sailed away from Dia without his newfound beloved. Ariadne was distraught at the loss of Theseus, and in despair at the prospect of becoming the consort to the hedonist god who had taken her by force of guile. But it was through the sacred strength of love that a miraculous change occurred in the god Dionysus. So enamored was he of the beautiful and pure Ariadne that he could not bear to see her in such anguish. He did not take her by force. Instead, he agreed that he would have her only when she agreed to be his wife of her own accord. Dionysus began to shower her with gifts and celebrate her beauty, even vowing to change his decadent ways to indicate the truth of his love for her. When Ariadne saw the extent of the god's devotion and how it had transformed him, her heart softened. Through her prayers to Aphrodite, the embodiment of all love, Ariadne came to understand that Theseus would have fought for her if he had truly felt in his heart that she was his one and only beloved. That he did not was an indication that she must now let him go. For love that is not requited in equal measure is not love at all. It is not sacred. And holding on to the ideal of such love can keep us from finding the one that is true. The day came when Ariadne agreed to be the wife of Dionysus, and they lived in a state of bliss into eternity as true and equal partners in the Hieros Gamos. Here it was that Ariadne found the love that is real, with the beloved who had indeed fought for her. Theseus, for his part, was left to mourn the loss of Ariadne, and regretted until the end of his days the weakness that led to his terrible decision to abandon her. In honor of she who was now a goddess, he created a temple in her name on the Isle of Amathus. Taking the statue of Aphrodite, which Ariadne had once carried with her upon leaving Crete, he created a structure which he called the Temple of Love, and he dedicated it to Ariadne Aphrodite. Within the temple, he built a labyrinth, which became the symbol of love and liberation. And a rhythmic dance that represented the celebration of divine union was established for the annual feast in Ariadne's honor, the feast of the Lady of the Labyrinth, who defeated the darkness with her love. The new labyrinth was created as a place of joy, with one sacred spiral path that led into the center and out again. No more would a labyrinth be a place where human souls were lost. Forevermore it would be a place where the human spirit could be found, a place to celebrate what is both human and divine in us all, once we learn to slay the minotaurs that lie within ourselves through our necessary belief in the power of love. Theseus became the greatest of heroes, establishing democracy and justice in Athens, where he is still recognized as the wise and compassionate founder of that city, which gave learning to the world. It is without doubt that his deep understanding of the nature of love and loss was the element that made him a great leader. For those with ears to hear, let them hear it, the legend of Ariadne, the Lady of the Labyrinth, as preserved in the Libro Rosso.
As told by Kathleen, and in the tradition of many people before who have read it from the Libro Rosso, and people who have seen the labyrinth for what it truly is. Now, at this moment in time, it's probably best to take a short break, and we chose a song by Arnie Williams, which is called Burning Wish. Now, Arnie Williams is a great composer of spiritual music, of music which transforms you pretty much into other dimensions, which is walking the labyrinth, which is what walking the labyrinth is precisely all about. So, without further ado, as they say, Arnie Williams with Burning Wish. Thank you. That's Annie Williams with Winning Wish. Now, if you want to hear Kathleen reread that section of the Book of Love, we have a website, thespiritrevolution.com, where you will find information about this show and also hear the archives of this show as well as some of our previous show. Now, Kathleen, why specifically did you want to read out this section of the Book of Love?
I love that particular version of the story of the labyrinth because it is so layered and it's so rich. There are so many elements to it. We could analyze that version of the story for the next, you know, days, hours, years. There's so much information in there about love. There's so much information there about the divine principle. And that's what I really wanted to focus on for a moment, is this idea that is it possible that in these Gothic cathedrals, remembering that all the Gothic cathedrals are called Notre Dame, Our Lady, they all have a powerful feminine component. Is it possible that one of the reasons for installing these labyrinths was a celebration of the female component? There is this element that Ariadne was the lady of the labyrinth, and I have certainly found in my studies that later on Ariadne is used in places to represent Mary Magdalene, in places where it was not acceptable to tell the story of Mary Magdalene. Often the story of Ariadne and the labyrinth is told in its place. And I talk about that rather extensively in the Book of Love, and I explain the history of that. But this concept that the labyrinth itself becomes metaphorical for a journey to the divine feminine is something that I think is extremely powerful and in many cases likely. This concept of dancing in honor of the Lady of the Labyrinth exists in the Gothic cathedrals all the way up until the 18th century. There was a labyrinth in Sens Cathedral until about the 1760s, at which point the local archdiocese decided to have it destroyed because of this dance that happened. And the dance actually happened during the Easter period and on Easter Sunday. And it was a dance of resurrection. And again, there's such a female component to this idea of this dance of resurrection, the women at the tomb when Christ is resurrected, and of course certainly Mary Magdalene being the first person who sees him and receives him during the resurrection on Easter. So is it possible that this feminine connection is what caused the churches to eliminate the labyrinth? You know, there's certainly no proof of that, but I think it's a question that needs to be asked. Certainly the other labyrinths, the labyrinth in Reims Cathedral that was torn out, also had a dramatic female component. This is also the cathedral where Joan of Arc coronated the king. So there are some very important events that happen in the history of women in spirituality that are then eliminated as a result of tearing out the labyrinth. So, you know, this is something that I want to talk about because it segues into this movement that I am hoping to create and that you are creating with me called Free the Labyrinth. The Free the Labyrinth movement is something that I'm aiming specifically at the labyrinth in Chartres Cathedral. If you have read the Book of Love and the Source of Miracles, you are certainly aware of my position on this. For those of you who are unaware of it, the most beautiful and perfect labyrinth exists in the nave of Chartres Cathedral. It's almost 43 feet across. It is built to an incredible geometric perfection. It is a work of art. It is an artifact that belongs to the world and deserves to be protected. There is nothing like it. It is completely unique. And a spiritual tool that was made as a gift to mankind. Chartres is a UNESCO Heritage Center, and as a result, Chartres is protected in a lot of different ways. It is also protected by the French government as a monument of France. In this regard, the statuary is protected and being restored. The stained glass is protected and being restored. And I certainly celebrate all that and would do anything in my power to encourage that and to encourage fundraising to continue the restoration of Chartres Cathedral, as it is, I believe, our most important temple. With all of those things said, the cause of my concern, my outrage, and my distress is the fact that the church covers the labyrinth in Chartres with chairs intentionally so that people cannot walk it. There is no need for them to cover the labyrinth with chairs. They do not require these chairs for services. They serve no purpose other than to cover and to damage the labyrinth. And this beautiful monument and artwork is being intentionally damaged on a very regular basis.
For those people who are not aware and who might jump on the next plane or in their car to drive over to Chartres, it actually has to be said that for most part of the year, the labyrinth in Chartres is covered up by these chairs, and it's only roughly between Easter and the end of September that on Fridays, roughly from 8 o'clock in the morning till about 5 to 6 in the afternoon, that the chairs are removed. Now, on most of those days, it's actually up to those people who are willing to walk the labyrinth that they themselves have to remove these chairs and move them literally out of the way. And definitely a labyrinth which has been built around 1200 is continuously scratched and torn and, you know, destroyed almost by this continuous movement, which is completely futile. There are many, many, many thousands of chairs in that cathedral, and there is no real purpose as to why those chairs should be covering that part. And it really is an act of damaging a UNESCO classified monument, and as such, a memory to everybody of mankind and people trying to get there.
I believe that covering the labyrinth in Chartres Cathedral with chairs is vandalism, plain and simple. It is an intentional attempt to destroy this beautiful symbol, damage it and keep it away from those who would come to walk it. And I get mail from people who go to Chartres specifically to see it after reading my books, and they come back to me and say, oh my gosh, I can't get into it. Couldn't see it. It was covered. And it is most of the time. I realize that this perspective is somewhat controversial. There are a lot of very beautiful people out there who have labyrinth movements of their own, who are doing great work to raise the awareness of the importance of a labyrinth, who are not really happy with me right now, if I'm honest, about the fact that I am being so vocal about what the church is doing in Chartres. But I just feel that something really, really wrong is going on here, and it needs to be discussed.
And what you're referring to is something which is or was happening in September when we were actually both there. And what is happening is that the church is now handing out leaflets, both in English and in French, which says that the labyrinth is not something which is there for self-help, which is not there to do anything which you're outlining of people connecting with God. They're actually saying that there is nothing controversial about labyrinths, and actually what is happening in Chartres is very much on par, but on a completely different level than what was happening at St. Sulpice during the Dan Brown episode of the success of the Da Vinci Code. At the time of the Da Vinci Code, thousands of people went to St. Sulpice, and of course Dan Brown had said that something was hidden there. What's happening in Chartres, partly due to the success of the Book of Love, which is very popular in France because obviously it tackles a French subject, and the Source of Miracles, the church seems to be in a defensive position whereby they do not want certain things to happen. They do not want to see a flourishing of this people reconnecting in a very Christian way, actually, to God themselves and using this labyrinth. And what we already saw in June is that the church really goes after people who just sit down in the center of labyrinth when it is actually open to the public. They do not allow this. And in September, they actually had guards alongside the labyrinth, practically waiting for somebody to sit down or do something which is considered to be not correct according to the church doctrine. And it's very much as if the Inquisition is only just a footstep outside of the labyrinth.
Sadly, and I've been doing this since 1995 in Chartres, although the labyrinth hasn't really been open to the public at all until since, you know, like the last decade, but I have seen this sort of move towards an Inquisition kind of feeling just in these last few months, in the last year, really. And I find that really, really distressing. There seems to be a cracking down on the labyrinth. I have actually been told by people who, quote, represent the cathedral that they don't, quote, want New Age wackos in their labyrinth. I have been interrogated in the last few months on my trips there. I have been asked if I believed in God. I have been asked to tell them specifically what prayers I am saying when I'm in the center of the labyrinth. I mean, there is a major interrogation that's starting to happen to people who are going to Chartres, who are beautiful people, pilgrims, devotional people who really just want to go there and pray and want to be left alone. And unfortunately, that's not happening. And this backlash towards intolerance is something that I think that we really need to talk about. And I'm going to be talking a lot about it on our new website, which is going to be up, freethelabyrinth.com. We'll give you more information on how you can find out more about it. We'll give you some resources. In the meantime, go to the website for this show, thespiritrevolution.com, and we'll get some things up there. One of the things I'm going to put up there is a link to a labyrinth locator. If you want to find a labyrinth in your neighborhood or in your local area, and go check out how this feels yourself. If you've never walked a labyrinth, I recommend it so highly. If nothing else, it'll be a great day out. It'll be a day of exploration, but it might just change your life like it did mine. So you can go to labyrinthlocator.com, put in your zip code, put in your city, your state. It will pull that up. But we'll have all those resources on the website for you, including things that you can do to start speaking out to protect this most important labyrinth in Chartres Cathedral, and how we can go forward and encourage the French government and UNESCO to protect this most important artwork from Middle Ages that belongs to everybody.
And just to round off the show, we return once again to Annie Williams and an excerpt from her song Voices of the Moor, and perhaps Voices of the Moor will become kind of the theme song of the Voice of the Labyrinth, and what will inspire you to go out into the world and find the labyrinth near you and actually walk it. Until we see each other there or once again on the radio show, this is Philip Coppens.
And this is Kathleen McGowan.
And this is The Spirit Revolution on BBS Radio. Our website is www.thespiritrevolution.com. Until next time.
Here's Annie Williams, and we'll have some more information on our website about Annie as well.